But first, producer Doug Gordon catches up with Kat Duff. She's the author of The Secret Life of Sleep.
Kat, what inspired you to write The Secret Life of Sleep?
I have always loved to sleep. It's always been a favorite thing of mine. And such a mystery. It's such a mysterious thing. What happens during all those hours that we can't remember? And as a writer, I like to explore those common everyday experiences that we tend to overlook or forget or pay no attention to. My first book was about illness, and when I sat down to start another writing project, the subject of sleep jumped on the page, and I thought, oh boy, this will be fun.
It sure is fun to read. As you mentioned, Kat, you've always liked to sleep, even when you were a young girl, and I may be in the minority here, but when I was a young boy, I didn't really enjoy sleeping at all. What was it that you liked about sleeping when you were young?
I loved the chance to let everything and everybody go and go in my own room. You know, we tend to romanticize childhood as a carefree time, but there's a lot of pressure to live up to everybody's expectations, and I loved being able to shut the door on that and go into my own room, be unsupervised and by myself, and have my own private experiences.
You write that our waking selves are like lily pads floating on the surface of our night selves. That's a really beautiful phrase. Can you elaborate on what you mean by that?
Yes, there's various levels of that. Very literally, our sleep lives support our day lives. There's so much that goes on when we sleep. We regenerate tissues, we build bones, we make memories, we strengthen our immunity, we sort through our emotional issues. So much goes on. We would not be anything in the daytime if we didn't have our sleep. So literally, sleep supports our day lives. But on another level, I've always had the sense that sleep is a bigger world than the one I inhabit by day. I think that cognitive psychologists are really beginning to confirm that notion as they begin to define the breadth and depth of our unconscious processing that goes on all the time. We'll notice it every now and then. For example, if you're trying to tell a friend about a movie and you can't remember the name of the movie, and an hour later when you're doing something totally different, it pops in your head. Well, during that hour, all that unconscious processing was going on and accessing information that you couldn't access in the moment by day. There's just such a large field of experience and knowledge that we get to tap into in our sleep.
Kind of a yin-yang thing, almost, a way our sleeping life informs our waking life and vice versa?
Yes, I think that's a wonderful analogy.
As the title of your book, The Secret Life of Sleep, conveys, we don't know that much about sleep because it lies outside of our conscious awareness. And you've done a lot of research into the science of sleep. How much do we really know about it?
Oh, well, I'm sure we're still scratching the surface. This scientific inquiry of sleep is actually fairly recent, just started up in the middle of the 20th century with the development of things like the electroencephalogram and other brain imaging techniques that have allowed us to find out that there's a lot of activity going on inside of us when we sleep. But when you get outside of that Western scientific tradition, there are traditions throughout the world that have thousands of years of observation about sleep. And one of the interesting things to me that I discovered in the research here is that ancient Hindu and Buddhist texts from BC times identified stages of sleep that are now being confirmed by neuroscientists here in the 21st century.
We're told that the ideal amount of sleep to get is 8 hours every night. Is this true?
Well, it is a normative average, but I'm sure most sleep scientists and sleep doctors would give you a range of something like 7 to 9 hours. It is a very individual thing. Some people don't do well unless they have 9 or 10 hours, and others can do well on 4 or 5. But that's the normative average.
Yeah, I think people like Martha Stewart and Bill Clinton have said that they get by on 4 hours of sleep. Do you think that's possible? Because that's half the recommended daily allowance. Do you think it's really possible to get by on that little sleep?
Well, as Bill Clinton has acknowledged, I think he literally said when he was asked if he would give any advice to the incoming President Obama, and he said, get enough sleep. He said, all the mistakes I've made in my political career were from trying too hard and not getting enough sleep. One of the tricky things about if you actually do need more sleep, but you're only getting 4 or 5, one of the first abilities that we lose with sleep deprivation is that capacity to observe ourselves and look at our behaviors. So someone may think they're doing just fine in 4 or 5 hours, but if you talk to their family, they'll say they're irritable and impatient. You talk to their coworkers, and they say they have to go over their work because there's so many mistakes. So we aren't always the best judge.
I want to talk about dreaming. There's one thing that I'm especially curious about. Are we conscious when we dream?
It's so interesting to think about that, isn't it? That was one of the surprising things as I started to read neuroscientists talking about sleep. Not all neuroscientists, but a good body of neuroscientists say, yes, we are conscious. Rudolfo Linus says that dreaming actually is consciousness itself in the absence of sensory input. And I think the key question is, what are we conscious of? When we're dreaming, we're very conscious of the imaginary world we've created for ourselves, we might say, that we call dreams. We aren't as conscious of what is going on in our environments.
You mentioned, I think, in your book that even ancient philosophers said that we're conscious when we dream.
Yeah, and even in the West. Yeah, you can go back to Aristotle and some of the others, yes.
Wow, so it's kind of like if those guys and the other people we were talking about, ancient civilizations, if they were still around, maybe they'd be further ahead in sleep research, just how prophetic they are. What do you think is the biggest sleep-related question that neuroscientists and sleep researchers are still trying to answer?
Well, I believe what they would say is why we sleep, because I've often heard that and read that from neuroscientists who study sleep. It seems an odd question to me, or an odd thing to think that we haven't answered that question, because we've identified so many things that happen in sleep that really couldn't happen when we're awake. But I think that the hesitancy to say that's the reason is because it's still hard for us to accept that we are basically earthly creatures. We are born on this planet that rotates and has alternating phases of light and darkness, and we are created in that milieu, and every plant and animal, every cell of our bodies, every single-celled organism has an inbuilt circadian cycle of phases of activity, phases of rest, and I think sleep is just a function of that, and it's hard for us to really believe that we're that earthly.
Throughout your book, you write about some of the dreams that you've had, and there's one in particular that I'd like to ask you about. I think you had this dream a few years ago. It was about a drive you took down a winding canyon road. Do you know which one I'm talking about?
I do.
Can you tell me about that one?
Yeah. The dream was that I was trying to go to Ojo Caliente, which is about an hour and a half away from home. And in the dream, I was taking this dirt road that goes there, and it has to go down into the Rio Grande Gorge, and so it winds along the side of a very steep gorge, little narrow dirt road, and then crosses the river and then goes back up the side of the other. And in the dream, I was driving a little too fast, which I am prone to do, and I came around a blind corner, and a car was right in front of me coming the other way, and I veered to miss the car, and I went over the edge of the canyon.
And then something happened the next day, because didn't you have to actually drive that canyon road?
I did. I was going to an appointment in Ojo Caliente, and it's very unusual for me to dream about something that I'm getting ready to do the next day. So when I had that dream, I thought, gosh, it scared me a little bit, and I contemplated going way out of my way to go a different way and not have to go down into the canyon, but I love that canyon. So I decided, oh, heck, I'll just leave a little earlier and take my time. And then, of course, you know, I was going along, and I'd totally forgotten about the dream. And I was heading down into the canyon, and I had all the windows open. It was a beautiful day. I had my favorite CD on. I was singing along, and I had totally forgotten about the dream. And a bee flew into my car. Now, at the time, I thought I was allergic to bees. I'd had a couple of big reactions to bee stings, so I was frightened, and I turned to look to see where the bee was. And when I looked back, there was a car coming the other way right towards me, and I veered a little bit to get out of the way, but we kind of skidded parallel to each other and around each other. I did not go over the edge.
Wow.
But I was really glad that I was not going as fast as I am prone to do.
Do you think you were not going as fast because of the dream?
I know that I had decided to leave earlier. That was my kind of response to getting that dream, because it was so unusual. Usually I dream about, oh, all sorts of other things or crazy things where I'm back in high school or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so this felt a little bit like a warning.
Yeah. Near the end of your book, you say that our sleep is being sold back to us. Can you explain what you mean?
Yes. You know, as I did the research and was writing the book, I came to realize that sleep is really a natural resource. It's like the air we breathe, the water we drink. And in fact, we need it as much as we need the air we breathe and the water we drink. In fact, without sleep, we would die sooner than we would without air or water.
That's a very powerful, poetic way of looking at it. You pose an interesting question at the end of your book that I'd like to ask you now. What does sleep look like from sleep's perspective?
I wish I could ask that of my sleep itself and have an answer. What I imagine it might look like is that sleep repairs the damage that we do by day.
How has writing The Secret Life of Sleep changed the way you think about sleep?
You know, I've come to think of sleep as my best friend and helper. I've always enjoyed sleeping, but I've never really realized how much it helps me and how much I can turn to it. I can turn to it to help me remember things. I can turn to it to help me solve problems, even little things. If I can't think of a birthday present for someone, I just go to sleep on it. And if I'm really upset about something, I tell myself, okay, don't stay up going over and over the same old line of thought you've had. Let it go, give it to your sleep, and see what comes out the next day. It's such a great ally and friend.
Kat Duff is the author of The Secret Life of Sleep. She spoke with Doug Gordon.